This episode and the entire run of the Simpsons One-Shot series is completely listener-funded through Patreon. We've just revamped our Patreon page and are offering more than ever to listeners, including exclusive series just for Patreon supporters. So if you want to learn how to help support this series and everything we do at NewsAz, check out our rebooted campaign at patreon.com/newsaz. Welcome to the Simpsons One-Shot Show. This is the series where we're taking a look at the Simpsons One-Shot Wonders line, one book a month at a time. We are up to the Malevolent Mr. Burns. We'll be discussing that today. I am Matt, and joining me, as usual, are my co-host Derek.
Hello, everybody.
And Karen.
Hello.
All right, the Malevolent Mr. Burns. This came out on June 26th. 2013. It's got five features, I guess you'd call it, because they're not all full stories. Little Monty Millions, Adventures on Bigfoot Mountain, Release the Hounds, Mr. Burns to the Rescue, Mr. Burns Bears It All, and Burnsy's Belly Laughs. So to start off with, I'll talk about the cover. I don't know how to say this because I don't know how to describe art and whatnot, but the colors on this thing hit like all the points of colors I like, which is weird because I generally don't like purple by itself, but when you mix it in with some blacks and greens and a little bit of yellows, this has been one of my favorite covers so far. And where those colors are coming from is, of course, Mr. Burns, the yellow part of it, in his blue suit, sitting on a purple kind of mauve-ish throne that looks like a vampire cape with these pointed ends coming up around the sides of his shoulders. There's Lenny, Carl, and Homer to his left behind the chair, and Smithers, they look scared. Smithers to his right, who looks happy with some hearts flowing. And then there's a green glow in the background that leads down to the floor where there's some toxic sludge, presumably from the power plant, one of his hounds, and his foot atop a three-eyed skull, which is a nice little touch too. And then the Malevolent is in orange and Mr. Burns in green. So this color, you know what it reminds? It's very Halloweenish, I think, is maybe why it speaks to me.
And we also get a appearance of Bobo.
Oh, yeah. He's got the, I always forget about it. Yeah. I forget the name of the teddy bear, but yes. Bobo looking much better than we last saw him on the show.
I think the shading in the face is one of my favorite parts. Other than the skull, the three-eyed skull, I think the shading in Burns' face.
Yeah.
Like it just seems like he's so evil and leaning out of the page at you.
Yeah, that's a good, you're right. Yeah, none of the other characters have that. Yeah. Yeah, it's a cool cover. I like this. Was $3.99 cover price. I think I got it for like 99 cents. Or no, this might have been even one in a pack my friend sent me. There's only a couple I had to buy. Again, comics, not the investments they were 20, 30 years ago at all. Anyway, so let's get started. Adventure on Bigfoot Mountain. And this starts off with a little Monty Burns pulling up to it's not even a baseball field. I think it's someone's yard. Driving through a neighborhood, the neighborhood kids are putting together a baseball game. Little Monty Burns jumps out in his, I don't know what you would call this, his schoolboy, this is my notes, the schoolboy uniform and Donald Duck hat. Because that's the best way I could describe the hat. I guess it's a sailor's hat, but it looked like Donald Duck.
Yeah.
His show, go ahead.
Donald Duck was a sailor.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think he was.
Yeah, he wore a sailor hat. Yeah.
Yeah. No pants.
He was always in the Navy.
No pants.
Right.
No pants. He never wore pants.
His chauffeur, which was, maybe we'll talk about this later, Smithersberry, has brought him and his dog Bankroll to this baseball game, or what Monty calls a tumble round of baseballing. They let him play. They assigned him the right field, and that is typically where you put your worst player, and I say that with a matter of confidence because that's typically where I was placed in baseball games. I was usually sent to right field.
Yeah.
Hockey, I'm okay. Track and field, that's the only thing I played in school. Baseball, that's not so much. Yeah, I don't know what it was about that. I have trouble watching it too. Actually, I do because I fall asleep. I love baseball season when I can't quite wind down on a Sunday. I put on a baseball game and I'm out like a light on the couch. When the game is kind of being set up, he meets Sue, is a little red-haired girl, which I don't know if it was with these being kids and playing, if this was an homage to Charlie Brown or not. But I think when I see a small redhead girl that has a love interest in a kid's cartoon, I always think Charlie Brown. And
yeah,
she introduces herself as Sue, of course. And Sue is what Monty's father does for sport, which I thought was a cute little line. Monty says his usual sports prowess and charm isn't winning him friends, so he invites some of other, quote, neighborhood players to join in the game. And these are the 1919 Chicago White Sox. So we get a year setting for this, which I wasn't even really thinking about how long ago this was until the year was mentioned. I don't know that it makes or breaks the story, but I was like, oh, okay, that just is back to the joke of how ancient Mr. Burns is, which has been a joke from the running of the show. So that would make him 100. Or no, if he's, wow, if he's like four, he's over 100. Well, he's already over 100, established over 100 in the show, isn't he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It fluctuates, but yeah.
Okay, gotcha. So the Chicago White Sox end up forming this team to play on Monty's team against the neighborhood kids. There's a short montage of the Sox scoring, hitting, arguing, drinking, and then a score tally of the home team 0, visitors 212. The neighborhood kids, the real neighborhood kids, they storm off. The game's ruined. Monty's a little frustrated or maybe even angry that he'll never make any real friends when Sue comes up to invite him to go with her and a few kids up camping at Bigfoot Mountain. Sue does ask him to try to be normal, laying a smacker on his cheek, and he insists he's absolutely going to be normal. And apparently normal for little Monty at this point begins with arriving on the mountain with a, it's almost like a antique or steampunk version of the Road Warrior gyrocopter landing, and him exclaiming huzzah. So that's apparently normal for Monty. Did you just agree, Karen?
Yeah,
that's normal.
Yeah, that's normal.
That's my
sure.
Those are my Thursdays. So Monty tries to fit in. So he immediately tries to fit in by joining the kids in their campfire. They're cooking hot dogs. He tries cooking mousse de foie gras over a fire, which just keeps melting off the stick. So again, kind of outcast, not fitting in. Monty and Bankroll retire to his tent, which is actually a small cottage, probably built overnight as the kids were hiking up to the mountain for him. Once he goes to sleep, he's awoken by a scream for help from Sue. So Monty, Smithersberry, and Bankroll, which at this point I finally noted, Bankroll doesn't say bark, he says brack, this poor little dog. Uh-huh. He's got like little googly eyes, so this dog is like not quite right. I love the look on the face of this dog every shot, just tongue hanging out, eyes going every which way, saying brack.
He looks like if Peabody got hit in the head with a brick or something.
Yeah. Right, he does. Yep. And there's a bit of a Sherman-esque Peabody look to them when they're hanging out of the side of the gyrocopter. So they run towards, or they hear this howl. They run towards it. Well, poor Bankroll actually gets drugged by his collar, which I'm not sure what I thought that was going to go somewhere, but it didn't. It's just like he's frustrated with the dog. He says he's going to stuff him, but then nothing else happens, which is, I don't know. I'm not sure what, maybe that was part of the story that got taken out. They didn't go back and fix that panel, whatever. Doesn't matter. So as they're going, they find a large set of footprints. They follow the footprints into a cave. They quickly learn that the cave is the entrance to the lost city of the Kingdom of the Lost Sasquatch Pyramid of Big Mountain. Just rolls right off the tongue.
Oh, yeah.
They make a joke that it's they need to find an easier name than that. Let's see. So all the Sasquatches naturally look like Homer, which is, I mean, it's a definite, well, first off, I mean, it's based off the Homer model, and it's not super far. It's actually, it's kind of, I was going to say it's like the Call of the Wild Homer, but it's actually, it's like a brown version of King Homer, I think, from the Treehouse of Horrors episode, because it's definitely ape-like. It's not Homer just covered in mud, but it's definitely a Homer-esque looking beast. the one of the Sasquatches start to approach them, Monty pushes Smithersberry in front of him and runs. I'm so trying not to say Sam Squanch. The Sasquatch catches Smithers, has little hearts floating around his head. Much later, during a massage and a milkshake recuperation, little Monty is almost feeling regret. I guess it's close enough to an emotion that he comes back to the cave with literally a small army. He returns to announce that he has procured the mountain and all these Sasquatches are being evicted. So Sue and the other kids are still there. They're trying to explain to him that the Sasquatches only wanted to be their friends and that Monty needs them to give their home back. Upon further reflection of what he's actually procured, Monty realizes that if he takes this mountain of gold, adds it to his piggy bank, he could buy the whole Springfield. And with that, this cave is a perfect location to build a power plant. Sue walks off in a huff, saying that you may have a mountain of gold, you may own a town, you may even own people, but you'll never have friends, to which Monty answers, turns out, I'm fine with that. And that is the end of that story, and a little look at little Monty's past. So this one, I didn't know what these stories were going to be, so I had to kind of get in the mindset that we're going through his life, as we're going to find out in the next story as well. But once I got through that, it was okay. It wasn't great. It had some laughs. I do have a canon. I guess it's a problem of canonization of a Smithers being with him his whole life. I mean, if I'm going to really nitpick for the comic, it's fine. Did love the dog though. The googly eyed dog with his tongue hanging out. As far as the drawings go, I really was looking closely at the kids to see if any of them are like Abe or Jasper or someone as a young thing. And I really could not even use my imagination to do that. So it's all Monty and Smithers, which is fine too. And then if I knew more about baseball history in 1919 White Sox, that probably would have been funnier to me, but I didn't quite get the joke, other than I guess they were crooked. I did like the Homers, the Sasquatch Homers. I like those. I like the City of Gold. And the I didn't mention that Smithers kind of fell in love with the Sasquatch in the end, and he's got clearly a Fred Flintstone robe on. Or do you want to call that a Fred Flintstone shirt? Whatever Fred Flintstone wears, Smithers is wearing it at the end there. And that's about all I have to say about it. I mean, it's a pretty cut and dry story.
Yeah, it reminded me of a Richie Rich, like an old timey Richie Rich comic. I mean, especially with the dog having dollar signs on it.
Oh, did Richie Rich's dog have dollar signs?
Yeah, I think he had more.
Okay, I didn't know that. If I knew that, that probably would have made me give me a better laugh.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's definitely that, you know, the little rich kid and trying to deal with the poor kids. The one thing that I did actually like about this story is the baseball game with the ringers kind of reminded me of one of my favorite episodes of The Simpsons, where they have the softball team. And Bart and Ralph are trying to pick baseball teams for the schoolyard game. And Ralph just happens that every time it's Ralph's turn, it's one of the all-stars that Burns snuck into the plant. So it's like Bart and Milhouse versus, you know, like Ralph and Barry Bonds and Daryl Strawberry. And, you know, so I kind of, it made me remember that, but it was an all right story. I mean, it was kind of silly.
I like when they do the that. I don't know why that reminded you of the baseball one. Your baseball story reminded me of the tennis one where Homer and Lisa. Or no, yeah, was it Homer and Lisa against Marge and Bart? And then they switch out for the Williams sisters, and then the Williams sisters switch out the Simpsons for other professional players, and ends up being a pro match. I remember that episode. I remember that being pretty funny. So kind of in the same, almost the same vein, but not quite.
And I liked Smithers' little mustache in this one. Yeah. He kind of looked like one of those like 80s pop crooner bands.
Oh, God. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, God.
You know what I mean?
It's the same mustache as the that one guy. We talked about him. Who's the genie in the... I think it was a little Homer episode. Yes. That guy, the yes guy, yeah. Who had a name, but I can't remember. Any thoughts on this, Karen?
I like the drawings of the kids, especially their makeshift baseball gear with the bird cage and the pillow tied to the front, and then the other kid's got the strainer on his face.
That's actually very Cosby Kids.
Yeah.
Oh God. Uh-oh. Now you ruined it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, Cosby Kids.
He didn't draw them. He just voiced half of them.
Oh, okay. I thought it would have been a little funnier, like when he lost Smithersby and they show his new valet, if he also looked like Smithers. I thought that would have been a little better.
That's a good idea.
They could have called him like Smithers C.
Yeah. Yeah.
Smithersworth. Worth.
Other than that, I mean, I thought the story might have been a little long, but it had to... There was really, you know, if they'd stopped with the baseball game, then it would have been too short.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's like, it is. It's kind of two in one. It's the, he wins the baseball game, and then you got the Bigfoot Mountain thing.
Then they go camping.
Which does make it a little longer than some of the other ones. You're right.
But I mean, I like the drawings the most, the ink work and everything. Yeah,
they're pretty good.
The story itself is kind of, it's okay.
Slightly different, little sharper edges, but still.
Yeah.
Still good. There's one we're going to, actually then two in the next issue that are completely off model. But that's not this issue. So, all right. I'll move on here. Who is taking Release the Hounds?
I am.
All right.
So, Release the Hounds takes place many years ago. So, it doesn't really give a time frame, but based on the look of Smithers and his not friends, I would say they're about college age, and they're hanging out at the Springfield Country Club, and a couple of the guys are about to go out fox hunting, and Monty wants to join them, but they obviously don't want anything to do with him. They pretend they don't hear him, or that it's a baby squirrel coming after them. And they make fun of him. They point out that he's just too skinny, basically, that the fox would end up chasing him, and that he just doesn't have the hunter's instinct. And then for a second, they're like, oh, they feel bad, but not really. So they leave him with Nipper, who's a useless runt of the litter of their hounding dogs. And they take off, leave him with this, what looks like a little cute little puppy. And as the look on him makes Monty remember something his father once said to him, which ends up being, stop dreaming about what I said in the past and go get your revenge, which is oddly specific.
That's a great panel.
Yeah, that was a great gag.
That's almost as good. That's like, that is in the same realm as that Treehouse of Horrors. If you ever find yourself back in time, be sure not to step on anything.
So he takes Nipper and he's going to go after those guys and get their vengeance. Nipper responds with a bark bark. And the editor's note is that equates to revenge. Yeah. So we see the guys hunting the fox. They've got the hounds are after it. Their fox is absolutely terrified. And as the hounds are running, they hear this giant bark, which scares the crap out of them. And they take off, yipping and yiping. And the two other guys, who we never get their names, they're just two snooty, snotty country club guys.
Leonard and Carlson. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, way to go.
They didn't let those types in the club back then.
That's right.
That's, yeah, well, yeah.
So they're yelling at the hounds for taking off. And we see that Smithers had Nipper bark into a megaphone, which made it 10 times louder. The country, Snooty Country Club, one of them notices something. And when thinks, oh, is it the fox? He's like, no, better. It's money. They follow the money, which ends up back at the country club pool and ends there. And then we see Nipper gives out a giant bark again, and the guys sploosh end up back in the pool. And Monty is standing over them saying, oh no, did someone fall into the pool with quick setting gelatin? Which is quite funny. That's a good idea.
Yeah, it is funny. I don't know that stuff exists though.
No, yeah.
Because when I'm going to try to make jello shots, it takes like 5 days for it to set up, it feels like.
So we see an old-timey Kent Brockman show up, and he wants to take a photo of this further article on fox hunting. And we see the headline, "The Day the Hunters Become the Hunted." And Monty is sitting with all of his, back in modern day, sitting with all of his hounds, telling the story of their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, his first hound, who ended up stuffed, which is his own fault because he shouldn't have bitten the taxidermist. And now it's time for them to get back to work after that motivational story and go chase after the nice man collecting for the church.
Yeah.
And see Flanders running off, thanking him for the story in plausible Ned Flanders way. And that is the end, and possibly the end of Flanders.
If only. Life is just this one crushing defeat until you just want Flanders dead.
I like this one a little better than the last one. Probably because it had to deal with the dog.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't say it's one of my favorites out of what we've read so far. But it's kind of like the underdog getting his comeuppance, but it's hard to enjoy that knowing what he becomes in his later years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He seemed too nice to the dog.
Yeah.
But it worked for the story.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you. It's like, this is better than the last one, but it's still not one of the best we've read. But I liked it too. And it probably, like you said, it probably has to do with the run of the litter, more getting his, more him getting over on everybody than Burns having much to do with it until the end when you get the great, yeah, great, great, great grandfather joke, which is kind of funny. The noise that they make going into the pool, ploop, is a very interesting choice, and I don't know, ploop, that's like if you dropped like a small solid object into a pool, like a golf ball, that's the exact noise it would make, which I thought was weird at first, but then they make the mention that it's quick setting jello, and I was like, I'm wondering if that was the choice of words to illustrate that they were landing into something more than water. I know I'm probably overthinking it, but when I read the word ploop, I immediately thought, I'm like, well, a horse, two guys on horses would not make a ploop sound. But then the jello thing came up, and I'm like, oh, I wonder if that was, you know, thought out to that detail, if it was just me. Usually in that case, it's just me, but
that's okay. I thought, how are they going to get the horses out of the water? Yeah. So, I mean,
I do like that they managed to make the horses safe. The one horse is there pissed off looking at the owner. The other horse has his mouth and nose just above the jello, so he's fine. He's just under the jello, but he can breathe. So at least they went out of their way to make it look like the horses were safe and not harmed in the drawing of this comic.
Yeah, this one I like better than the first one, definitely. You know, every now and again, I mean, it's rare, but every now and again, they have an episode where you see Burns being slightly compassionate, even with when Santa's Little Helper had the puppies, you know, so you could see that, you know, he would be nice to this dog. And I mean, I'm sure at some point he probably kicked the dog later, but you know, if it means getting revenge on people that are one-upping him, then I'm sure he would be nice to the dog. I had to look up, if you notice, the megaphone has the words Rudy Valley brand megaphone on it.
Oh, God. No, I didn't even notice.
Oh, Rudy Valley. Yeah. Rudy Valley was a band leader in the 20s and the 30s.
Ah, okay.
So I was just curious because, you know, usually they don't put something like that much detail into something if it doesn't mean something. Right. So I guess we can assume that it's like the 20s or 30s, which would put him at that college age.
Yep. That's probably why they picked that name. You're probably exactly right. That's our date indicator.
Yeah. And I love between this book and the next story and the TV show, I love that it seems like the thing that he loves the most more than his money is his hounds.
Okay. That's a good point. He actually does. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Except for those Dalmatians who want to make a suit out of.
Well, yeah.
I mean, the greyhounds.
Greyhounds, yeah.
And the ones that he filled with bees that shoot bees out of their mouths.
I wish we could actually train a dog to do that.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that was better. But yeah, just not the strongest one we've read. I'm just repeating what Karen had said. So we're up to Mr. Burns to the rescue. Is that yours, Derek?
That is me. Right. Before we do that, did you have the physical book?
Yeah, I do. So I wasn't sure where to mention this, but that's a good place to mention it. You're talking about the Fruit Batman mask, right?
Yes.
In the middle insert.
And the certificate.
Yes. Salutations, children. You now may engage in role play of the finest caliber with the included Fruit Batman identity concealer. Simply cut along the dotted lines, attach some woven string, and let the jollification commence. But be forewarned, clowning, buffoonery, roughhousing, shenanigans, monkey business, or antics of any kind will not be tolerated and will result in the revocation of all Fruit Batman-related merchandise and rights. Play responsibly. See Montgomery Burns. This is one, it's the Fruit Batman thing. I had it, the storyline on Untapped. Obviously it's in this comic. We'll say the last 5-6 years of The Simpsons, I kind of catch in bulk later after airing. This is one episode that's completely escaped me. So I don't know anything about the Fruit Batman storyline or story, I should say.
Yeah, I remember seeing it once. I honestly couldn't tell you. Okay. It may have actually been a Treehouse of Horrors or something like that, but I'm not sure. But yeah, I had him on Tapped Out too. And the little bat signal.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. Do you know what it is, Karen?
No.
Okay.
No, this one eludes me, too. I'm
looking it up. See, there's a ton of screen captures, but could you mention anywhere in this article what episode this is from, by chance, Simpsons Wiki? First appearance, Dark Knight Court. Okay, let me click on that link. And it is Season 24, episode number 524. So it's, I guess that's episode five. Okay. I will have to someday check it out because now this is the second appearance in something I own, Simpsons, that I have no idea what it's about, but, and still don't. Mm-hmm. So I'll just have to find out later.
Yeah.
All right. Mr. Burns to the rescue.
Yes, story number three is Mr. Burns to the rescue, as Matt said. We start with Burns sitting at the kitchen table, wondering where his dinner is and asking for Smithers to no reply. Apparently, he gave up on that, managed to draw himself his own bath and get his rubber ducky, but there's nobody there to scrub him. So again, he asks where Smithers is. Then you see him outside and he says one of my favorite lines, well, the hounds aren't going to release themselves. So he screams at the top of his lungs for Smithers. And then you hear the dogs howling as well. So he is very angry that he cannot find Smithers. He's checking all over the house and decides that it's time to use his fabled power of total recall, which I don't remember him ever mentioning right, before. Yeah. So he starts thinking for a little while and goes, oh, I remember as if it were yesterday. The next panel says yesterday. So Burns is sitting at breakfast and scolding Smithers. telling him that his bacon is too wrinkly and floppy and that he needs to go get the left-handed bacon stretcher so that his bacon will be straight. Smithers laughs at him and says, "Oh, left-handed bacon stretchers are a fable, and we used to tell that to kids on camping trips so that they would go wandering through the night looking for it."
Is that like a snipe hunt?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. It's a very bizarre version of a snipe hunt. Yeah. Burns screams at him and tells him to go find it right away, and off he goes into the house yelling "Eep." So we get back to present day, and Burns is trying to figure out where he is, and he says, "Smithers has been my lackey for years, but even he doesn't know all the secrets of Burns Manor yet." He opens up the head of Ayn Rand, much in the way that old Adam West Batman would open up the Shakespeare bust, and two poles appear behind a wall.
I actually had to stop, put down the comic, and looked up Ayn Rand because I did not know who that was. And now knowing who it is as a philosopher, playwright, and screenwriter, I'm still confused at why this one instead of... Well, I mean, I guess it's a more... Well, I was going to say modern, but she died... She was born in 1905 and died in 1982. I guess a slightly more modern Shakespeare, I guess, is the idea. I get it now.
I think it may have just been a joke for the writers or something, because it's clearly not a Burns-related joke.
Yeah, that's what I was expecting. I was expecting her to be like the Marie Antoinette of nuclear power. Like she had something to do with like science or whatnot to find out it's just a different writer. Yeah, you're right. I'll go with that.
So he slides down the pole and is suddenly dressed what appears to be in a Robin costume. And wants to know who was messing with his poles. My guess is it was probably Smithers. so he starts...
Smithers would be the most likely cosplayer in Burns' association.
Yeah, Smithers and comic book guy go sliding down the pole. Anyway, that's a whole other story. Yeah. So Burns spends the time to change into his suit again, which I guess he had a suit hiding in the basement as well. He starts walking past the guillotine. He walks past a couple of skeletons who he remarks look pretty good and have lost some weight. He walks past some ghost pirates and they say "arg" to him. So he replies with "arg indeed." He walks past Bilbo Baggins fighting the giant spider, which just seems really random. He then walks past the mole men and their drill coming into Earth. And finally, he walks past the devil, who just says, "Hey, boss."
Yeah.
And he refers to him as Rupert.
Rupert.
We finally get Burns into a room where Smithers is hanging from a golden cage. And there's a minotaur who is sharpening his axe, telling Smithers that he is going to die for trespassing. Burns decides to stop this, and the minotaur turns to attack Burns. When Smithers goes, "Oh no, not Mr. Burns."
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying I love that little bit that it's like this giant, deadly attacking minotaur, and then he cowers and is like literally cowering away from tiny
everybody
skinny Mr. Burns.
Everybody cowers at Mr. Burns.
Yeah.
So the minotaur turns into every other office employee on the planet and is like, "Oh, sorry, boss. Sorry. I didn't even realize it was you. I've been down here so long and my eyes have gone to shit. And, you know, I didn't realize." So Burns tells him to relax and just find him his left-handed bacon stretcher. And of course, the minotaur starts digging through his mess and pulls it out. So he goes, "Great. Now breakfast meats. No more cured breakfast meats for anyone." So the next panel, the final panel, is all of the people that Burns bumped into down below, the spider, the pirates, the mole men, the devil, and the minotaur, all enjoying some straight bacon. And we see Smithers in the corner saying, "Sir, I haven't eaten in 2 days. Do you mind if I eat anything?" And Burns just saying, "Quiet, you."
Yeah.
And all of the monsters do a nice little hooray cheer for Mr. Burns. Yep. And that's the end of this story. I liked it. I thought it was silly. I always, you know, every time they do an episode that's based inside of like Burns Manor. I always love when, you know, they walk past the most random stuff in the basement. So to the idea that he would have a dungeon with a minotaur in it doesn't seem too far fetched.
Right, yeah.
You know,
you're right. None of this seemed, I didn't have to suspend disbelief about anything.
I mean, he does live on a giant hill and you have to wonder what happens under those layers, mm-hmm. you know, but yeah, I enjoyed it. I liked the artwork in it. I liked how menacing the minotaur looked until he realized who he was standing in front of. And began cowering, and then they kind of turned him into more of a cartoony look. Mm-hmm. So he went from like a sharper, heavier line to kind of like everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. But, more fluid to him too, in a sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really enjoyed this. I think so far, this is my favorite of the three stories.
Yeah. No, this was, it's because, and it probably has a lot to do with it being the Mr. Burns that we know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's his personality and the fact that he's making all these evil, terrible beings. Well, first he walks past a skeleton, then he goes to go. Actually, yeah, I didn't realize it goes kind of in sequence, go from dead bodies to ghosts to mythological or just creatures to actual beings. But that's just a side note. It's definitely more what you expect out of a Mr. Burns story. Yeah, I like this one. This one I like the best of the three. I like the drawing. Again, I like the coloring of it in the dungeon. Again, I guess it's the dark, and you get a lot of earth tones and little splashes of green here and there. And it's more of a darker story. I like the little I don't know what you would call them. The little impy,
the mole men.
The group of them, because they don't even say what they are. He just walks by them, but then it fills out the table of evil beings in the end really well.
Right. Well, he's got the big drill, and they're all squinted.
That mole men makes sense then. Okay. Yeah. All right. That's a good description. Yeah. I looked up Ayn Rand some more because I was like, it was really bothering me that I didn't understand. I didn't realize she wrote Atlas Shrugged. That actually sheds a lot of light on it. And apparently she's known for quite a lot of things. But the one that jumped out at me is that she's one of her earliest of many, what would you say, political spotlight type things was her criticism of the women's liberation movement, which fits right in with Burns. And there's a lot of other stuff here too that makes this make much more sense why he'd have Ayn Rand and not William Shakespeare on his desk. Actually,
yeah, does make sense.
Most of it's a little kind of disturbing and really makes me. I don't think that some of the stuff they are directly relating, but the Atlas Shrugs and the women's lib thing would definitely fits with Burns. So that I needed to know. It was bothering me. It's like, I know the name, I don't know why, and then I finally put pieces together. That's my history lesson for the day. Always got to walk away learning something. Usually it's a character name that I messed up that you guys correct me on, but this time it was Ayn Rand.
Oh, we're getting deep now.
Yeah, right.
I know, right?
What do you think, Karen?
I also enjoyed this more out of the three, most out of the three. And it probably for the same reason, you get the glimpse of what's actually going on underneath Burns' house. I like the Batman reference and that they put him in Robin's costume instead of the Batman costume.
Yeah.
I thought that was a nice switch. And that he, you know, the idea that the devil works for him and that the devil's name is Rupert.
Yeah.
It's the most out there name that you could give to the devil. It's awesome.
Rupert's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. And I like my bacon straight too. So.
I just like bacon. I don't care. I'm not that picky.
Oh, yeah.
I like that the pirate ghosts are clearly Captain Crunch and Jack Sparrow without being Captain Crunch and Jack Sparrow. That's a nice
thing. I didn't even notice that. That's hysterical.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed the Jack Sparrow. I didn't even put together the Captain Crunch.
Yeah, I like this one too. So that leads to the last two, real short ones. First is First is Burns Bears It All, and it starts off with Smithers asking how he got the polar bear that's in Burns' office, and Burns starts telling a story of how it was the 1980s. Well, that's not that long ago, actually. Oh, he's the right age, I see. He was out to club a baby seal, and I just noticed now as I'm going through this that the SS Bobo ship behind him. Mm-hmm. So is that the icebreaking ship that eventually brings back Bobo? That'd be funny, actually. But so he's at the club of seal, basically. This is what's weird. A polar bear comes to attack him. He rips his shirt off, and then the next panel is him having defeated the bear. We actually never see any altercation.
The bear just passed out.
I guess, yeah. So we go back. They're looking at the stuffed bear. And that the story, and the last panel is you actually see a price tag pinned to or tied to the tail of the polar bear. It says $3,000 sold to Mr. Burns. So, it was okay. More than this, although it's missing, it reminds me of the, who was it? I don't remember whose comic it was. The style reminds me of another one we talked about. It was a Milhouse one, but it's not quite the same style because it's not the same artist. And what's missing is like the little sound effect noises out of each of the panels. Oh, and that would have reminded me of it exactly. But it wasn't this artist, so that's probably why it's not there. It was okay. I mean, you kind of saw where the joke was heading. We get the letters, a couple ads, and then the back, which is Burnsy's Belly Laughs. And this has to be a Dilbert reference, because I was reading each of these like they were a Dilbert send-off.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually really like this little story. Basically, Burns and Smithers are talking to the Minotaur, and the Minotaur says,
Minotaur, no, that's what it is. Jeez, yeah. Okay.
he was normal until he started working at the plant, and all the radiation turned him into a Minotaur. And then later, he's talking to Homer, and Homer is asking him, oh, you know, how did this happen? And he's telling the story. He goes, oh, well, where did you work? And he goes, oh, I worked in Sector 7G, which is obviously where Homer works.
Right.
And then what you can't see behind Burns's head is that he calls Marge, and he's like, hey, Marge, I'm going to come home early today because I'm feeling a little horny. And Marge is like, oh, you're a dirty bird, but you could come home and get some snuggle time. And then you pan, and he's like, yeah, that's not what I meant. And Homer's dressed, you know, got the horns now. So I thought it was funny. I mean, it was, like you said, it's a lot. It's a lot in one little page. But, you know, it was definitely a funny little, like, Saturday morning cartoon, like a comic strip joke. You know what I mean?
Thank you for going through the details on that. So that, and it just, yeah. Very Dilbert-esque. I mean, not only the drawing is a little rough for Dilbert, but I really thought the pacing of it was very Dilbert-esque as well for some reason. I don't know how else to describe it, if that's a good description, but
the drawing always reminds me of like when you see inside Homer's head and it's like the cow.
Oh, geez. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, I would have never thought of that, but you're right. Yeah.
Or when they do like old-timey Homer and Marge thing. I forget what that cartoon was called. Like that they used to have like the old timey, and they would always be bouncing.
Yeah. It was four animated frames over and over and over again. Yes. Now, so okay, for the rating, this one it's definitely not one of my favorites. The last bits of it save it. The last Burns story. I like looking at the pages of that bear story, even though it's a story you've heard a thousand times. I like the last page, the kind of I was calling it a Dilbert-esque homage. Maybe it's not so much now, but that's what I thought of it when I looked at it. So with that, I'm not going to really score it super low, but it's the definite middle of the roader. If we're doing it out of five, I'd say it's at best a 2.5.
Yeah, I would go the same. There were a couple of things in each of the first two stories that I liked, and then I really liked the story that I had. And like you said, the two little strips at the end definitely saved it. The guy that did the art for the bear story, let me see if I can grab his name. I've met him at a show one time. he does some like weird other comics, but he also does like a lot of shows for Cartoon Network and stuff like that. His Dan Rankane or Dean Rankane. I'm probably mispronouncing that. I'm sorry, but he's a pretty good artist. I mean, I've met him at a show or two, and his stuff is kind of crazy and fun to look at.
Yeah, that's
so good. It was kind of cool to see that in there.
That's a good description. Fun to look at. Absolutely. That's your cue, Karen. Me and Derek already rated. Okay.
Oh, okay.
I think we need like a bell or something.
Bing.
Bing. Yeah, I give it about the same, maybe like a 3, because I did enjoy this one a little more than the Frink one, because I like Burns more.
You're just not going to let that go.
And there was no fat.
The Frink, if the, I forgot about that. Aww. If the Frink one had a jingle, you wouldn't be saying that.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe, I don't know.
Professor Frink, I'll make you laugh, I'll make you think. Like that? You like that jingle?
No, not really.
I knew it. I knew you didn't. As soon as I said it, I was like, she's not going to like that.
I like the impression.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was pretty good. But yeah, but it's pretty much the same reasons. It's the last couple segments that save it. But there was a few things within the first few that I liked. I liked the great great grandfather puppy, and it was okay. It wasn't great, but it was more so for the storylines than the character itself.
Okay. So what did you give it? I'm sorry?
A 3.
3? So basically like 2, what is it? That's a lot of math of the 0.5 and a 3. So it's like 2.65, 2.7. So not super low. I mean, if we haven't gotten down to anything where we're saying this sucks, it's a 1 or a 2. So that's good, I guess. Yeah, not the best, but fun in the end. And you could tell, actually, I noticed as we were talking, we were kind of just going through the stories, the first two. I'm like, oh, man, are we that rusty? But then we had a story that we were, like, talking about, and that's discussing.
Yeah, the first story was long just in itself, but, you know, I mean, there wasn't a lot going on in it, and you're just like, all right.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I think our discussion of the comic, the flow of our discussion is exactly how that thing flows. Just kind of like, and then you have fun with it. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, that is it for this episode then. So we'll be back continuing the One Shot Wonders with the wonderful world of Lisa Simpson, but that'll be the next episode. Until then, check out not only the past episodes of this series, if you're just starting it, check out everything we do at neozez.com. That's where all our shows are. This show can be found on iTunes and just about anywhere else that you get your podcast from. And the feed is also available on the Simpsons One Shot Show page at neozez.com as well. Our social media pages, if you want to follow what goes on between the episodes, we are Neozez Podcast on Facebook and Neozez on Twitter and Instagram. So with that, let me thank you, Karen and Derek, for joining me once again.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
And let me thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.